Okay, welcome back. Comfortably and Numb is now comfortably immersed into its second season. My name, in case you've forgotten, is Blake Anderson, the program's manager here at the Umbrella Society, and also the host of this podcast. I'm coming at you today from beautiful Victoria, British Columbia, on the traditional unceded territories of the Algonquin-speaking people. And this time of year is where Victoria might not seem as beautiful to some, as we're heading into the rainy gray season. Definitely the tourists start fading away at about this time of year, but I'm constantly finding so much that I'm grateful for in this city. Though we may have serious challenges with regards to addiction, mental health, and homelessness, I'm constantly buoyed by the fact that there are so many wonderful and talented individuals in our community who really care and are making a difference to our most vulnerable. One of these individuals is actually on our podcast today, as we take a bit of a left turn from our regular programming by welcoming Dr. Doug McGee. Dr. Doug has been a member of the Addiction Medicine Consult Service, which runs in both the Royal Jubilee and the Victoria General Hospitals. This is a team that's comprised of a doctor, a social worker, and an umbrella support worker. This team meets with any individual who has presented in the hospital where substance use is or is suspected to be involved. So the team has the challenge and the task of creating a discharge plan that will support the individual and aims to provide a continuum of care in the community. So this team works very closely together, sharing the duties of having difficult conversations surrounding change, navigating the system by way of referrals, and also assisting the medical staff ensure that the individual gets the medical attention that they require while they're in the hospital. The dedicated members of this team do absolutely exceptional work day in, day out. And Dr. Doug has been part of this program since its inception and has been instrumental in developing this program into what it is today. But Doug's experience in the field of addiction, mental health, and homelessness goes back about 20 years when way less attention was given to addiction supports. This was at a time when methamphetamines had hit our society like a massive wave, and Doug was on the front lines and became immersed in trying to support struggling individuals. Doug's experience and insight are incredibly powerful, and the work he does continues to make a gigantic impact in our society. I'm really pleased to welcome Dr. Doug to our program. All right, Doug McGee, Dr. Doug McGee, thank you so much for coming in. Yeah, this is our first doctor that we've had on the podcast, and I'm really excited that it's you that has come in to chat with us. As a little bit of background, I've known Doug now for well over 20 years. We've been working out at the same gym. I'd say for about 25 years, hey, Doug?
Yeah, I'm the big guy in the gym, I think.
That's right. He pushes all of us little guys around. The reason why I wanted to bring you on, obviously, you know, your work with our AMCS team and your work in addiction medicine is just, you know, you're a bit of a legend in these parts, and everyone always talks about working with Dr. Doug, with quite a lot of reverence. But also for my sake, I just remember back in the day, you know, you talking about getting into this field, back 20 plus years ago and getting into the addiction side of things. And I always thought that was great because that was a time when really there wasn't a lot of concerted effort surrounding and a lot of, attention brought to addiction. So I thought you kind of got into it almost at ground zero in a certain sense. I would love to hear a little bit of your background and what got you going in addictions medicine. What was your interest and where did you get your start? I'd love to hear a little history about, your career.
Thanks, Blake. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome.
And I mean that. I've always admired you. And you're right. I think we met 20, 21 years ago at the Y. I've got a gym problem. And I guess I'm not alone in that. But... it's been really sweet to have that thread along the way, the gym thread in my life. But it was about 21 years ago that I mean, there were some formal training programs elsewhere, but I was volunteering with street youth and I just needed to do something with my career, salvage it, basically. I'll tell you that in a minute. Yeah. And it was a really cool time because there was a funding for enhanced skills, and I was working with street youth and we needed a clinic in town. And so I was able to get 6 months funding to learn street youth medicine. And it had never been done before. Like, nobody had ever studied formally street youth medicine. And for me, that was this blend of psychiatry and addictions. And at the time, it was really cool because crystal meth, I mean, intellectually and from a training perspective, was really cool because crystal meth was sort of this big tsunami of drug politically. And so crystal meth is probably our most psychiatrically destabilizing drug, like acutely, like people get psychotic from it more than other drugs. And so it was this perfect blend. You know, if I studied crystal meth in street youth, I would learn about mental health indirectly. And if I studied crystal meth, I'd learn about addiction indirectly and flesh it out. So that's about the time you and I met. I was heading on that journey.
Right. Yeah. Now, how hard was it to get, you know, funders on board and actually get that program up and running?
Well, that was a remarkable thing. You know, going back probably 10 years before that, I had graduated in a time when there was family doctors being squeezed out of the hospital. We were being restricted in our billings. International grads like from Australia and Ireland and South Africa were being discouraged from coming here. We were, as new grads, discouraged from working in BC. And it was a super disheartening time. There was no funding for anything. And if we tried to work, we were, you know, billings were revoked. And basically, I wasn't getting paid for things. And it was honestly a really disheartening time. And I was so lucky because I discovered rock climbing, to be honest. Okay. And why did it take me so long to find something I love so much?
Right.
And I just fell into it. I met a really cool group of climbers in town, and by some descriptions, I probably developed a problem to climbing.
Right.
And so I was in the gym a lot training for that when you and I met. But, you know, after a certain time, I grew up and the climate had changed. And by the time I was looking for support to try to salvage my career and maybe study street youth medicine, the things had changed. And I put it out one day at the advice of a friend to maybe try to get some funding for that. And I had funding within hours or certainly by the end of a day. Oh, wow. The question was, when do you want to start?
Okay.
So it was totally different.
So the need was just so evident? Is that?
Well, the need was evident to enhance the skills of family doctors. If they were in a community where they saw a need and they didn't have the skills or the knowledge base and they wanted to develop that so that they could serve a population, the funding was there. And that was, you know, kind of focused on inner city and then rural. And I was interested in the inner city, and nobody was looking at street youth medicine. There was no street youth clinic in town. There was no youth clinic that was addressing the needs of the highest risk, marginalized, street involved, sexually exploited, drug using youth. It was when I put my hand up, it was an immediate yes.
Okay.
So when do you want to start?
Right. Wow. That's got to be empowering.
No, it was terrifying. Totally terrifying. Right. I was a rock climber. Right. I was living in my van half the year and then to suddenly go like, oh, I'm going to really be a doctor and I'm going to do something in this town and I'm going to stand up and I'm going to be, it was terrifying to try to imagine myself being consistently available, responsible. Yeah. It was a big change in my life.
Right.
I just want to hang out in the gym and go climb. And that was fading out. And
but
it was an act of desperation.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. So what did those first, you know, so you get the grants, what did those early days look like? You know, how do you set up when there really isn't an established infrastructure already in place? How do you, you know, get something like that up and running and you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, the training itself was really empowering. I did some time in Toronto and hung out kind of in the underbelly of Toronto for a while and at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, you know, downtown Toronto. Had great teachers, both on the ground in the inner city, late at night, like this is what's happening here. And in these academic centers, super nuanced teaching. Downtown Vancouver, I was paired with Dr. Cornell, who was at the time doing excellent addiction work at Three Bridges. You know, the drawing sort of, you're providing care to inject crystal meth injecting male sex workers. fascinating. And I attended raves. I worked at St. Paul's Emerge. So, and then I started attending all these addiction conferences, and the giants of the day were really distant mentors to me. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was also volunteering a lot with AIDS Vancouver on the Y outreach, and a lot of the outreach workers were also my mentors at the time. So the training was super, super exciting. And then I came back, and the youth clinic was at a transition. They had a youth clinic in Esquimalt and at a school, and they were looking for, they're in a transition time. And I said, you know, basically, like, let's hit the inner city. Let's go downtown. And mm-hmm. and there was sort of no hesitation. And the Youth Empowerment Society had a space, and we just opened shop. And so it was actually really, and then there was this momentum because crystal meth was big. People were scared about it. I was giving a lot of talks around crystal meth at the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So politically there was a lot of interest and funding and, you know, adequate funding at the time.
Right. And so, you know, as far as the actual work with the, you know, the street entrenched youth that you're working with and, you know, early stages of crystal meth, what did that look like as far as daily practice was concerned, like coming in and having to learn on the floor, I guess, right? Like learn 100%. As you go and, you know, yeah, there must've been some trial by error on how to approach this growing and also really unknown, you know, almost epidemic that was hitting us right at the time.
Totally, Blake. I mean, I think you say it well, that it was just sort of figuring out as I went or as we right. went collectively and learning from the youth, learning from like the outreach workers, the social workers, the street workers, like the support workers. And then just reflecting with these distant literature body and academic mentors and just trying to pull that all together into the day to day. But honestly, the youth were my biggest educators. It was an interesting time because crystal meth was the first time that the internet was functional enough that it allowed for the immediate dissemination of recipes, the refinement of those so that synthetic drugs could be made in small, you know, like literally in a van, right. could be made anywhere by almost anyone. It was a totally different world where, you know, before it was a secret handshake and you had to get into, you know, organized crime to find out what the labs look like. And
right.
so this was new. Crystal meth was going to be everywhere. Yeah, I've lost my train. Where were we going?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you brought that up. It, you know, the landscape almost changed overnight, right?
Totally.
You know, with the, you know, the accessibility and that, like you're saying, everybody now, you know, could kind of get in on this and but as far as you providing support at this time, what did that look like? I mean, you know, did you have any idea on what you're, you know, getting yourself into? You said that, you know, you understood that there was a psychiatric component, and this is something that's, I don't know if we even, you know, we still seem to not have a grasp on is the, you know, drug-induced psychosis and that's involved with something like crystal meth. But at the time, you know, when you're just starting off, that must have been fairly daunting to.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. No, thanks for reminding me or bringing me back on track. The cool point about crystal meth is that it was, you're right. It was kind of like a surprise and light switch kind of evolution of the drug use. And prior to that, youth were using heroin. They were smoking and injecting heroin, snorting heroin, and then a collection of other drugs, alcohol, cannabis, and some other hard drugs, but it was mostly heroin. And there was, and suddenly everybody was smoking meth. So the injection drug use issue evaporated overnight. The justification for, or the need for like opioid agonists, like methadone at the time, it just wasn't there. Nobody was, you know, it was trivial amounts using heroin. So suddenly we had all these psychotic youth, we had no good treatment and the things that I had been anticipating needing, like methadone and, you know, right. formal treatment and these well-established drugs, it just wasn't valid. So it right. became a very relational kind of approach where we were doing motivational enhancement and, you know, building trust and getting people in the door who are, you know, kind of like wolves circling a camp, trying to make it low barrier, no rules, and then just build trust so that people can engage with psychosocial supports.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. So really taking it on that social, the social aspect of
totally.
Addiction.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
The interpersonal, psychological work of trying to unravel the addiction from that perspective, rather than like, oh, we can stop cravings and protect overdose with methadone, you know.
Right.
That wasn't valid.
Right.
There's nothing I could do.
So we had to dig
medically.
We had to dig deeper.
And, totally.
Right.
Totally.
Find out what else was other interventions at play. Yeah.
And there's one other part too, which is that, you know, this was happening while I was training, and so I was like, oh my gosh, this is really wild. Like the youth are telling me meth is everywhere. So I put calls out to the inner city doctors, like, who should I talk to? Who knows about what? And I was like, no, who should I talk to about this crystal meth stuff and the psychosis and the, you know, how do we approach it? And like, dude, nobody
knows.
No, you're studying it. You should do that. You should tell us. You should be part of the vanguard of figuring this out. And so I was totally winging it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was that kind of, you know, did you take that on and take that challenge on to be the kind of the driving force and trying to figure out how to, you know, what proper interventions were needed?
I did my best.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tried.
Right. Right. And I mean, as far as, and how do you message that to the greater body of, you know, how does the word get out? How, you know, and this is something that I'm, you know, curious just at large, you know, it seems like the climate changes overnight, and how is like, you know, doctors and professionals, how do you adapt to that when it's, nobody knows what to anticipate, you know, like it seems like these waves happen. How do you get on top of it?
Yeah. I mean, we, I think there's sort of three or four things we, you know, that I was involved in that we were trying. The first thing was I was studying it, and and at these conferences, and I would be asked to provide some, you know, I'd talk about it. Mm-hmm. And we did a survey, basically a study of high school kids in Victoria and street involved youth, try to get a sense of what was happening, and publish those, you know, so we're publishing it, we're speaking about it, set the youth clinic up and tried to become a sort of a center of excellence, and got some medical students and some psychiatrists, and, you know, tried to build that momentum of an inner city clinic like Kool-Aid, but for youth, that was a center for learning and care,
right?
Mostly care, but learning is a huge part of it. To disseminate, you know, publicly, we did, I made a video with street youth. So I gave a bunch of kids, street youth, cameras, and asked them to go out and create a photo novella or document what their experience with crystal meth, right, and drugs were at the time. And then we made a film with their voiceover on these images.
It's like a day in the life, essentially.
And they were the experts. They were telling us, right? In this film, I was honestly quite proud of that and my involvement in that and their work. And then we had a zine that the youth were making, and they were trying to disseminate knowledge to other youth through that. Mm. So the film was shown in schools at times and talks sort of for the public, publications and talks for physicians and other healthcare providers and all the other community providers. And then this zine to try to spread knowledge from youth to youth directly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That peer kind of, education piece.
Exactly.
Oh, really cool. Right.
Yeah.
So how long did you end up doing that for? Like, this was this a long, I think it was long tenure?
Yeah, no, exactly. It was surprising because I was so terrified and inexperienced. But I managed to stick around for 7 years before I sort of aged out of it. Yeah.
Right. Right. And, you know, during that time, obviously, you know, you probably saw as far as your experience and your skills when you're on the ground floor like that, that must have been a incredible learning curve and pretty big growth opportunity for yourself as well as a doctor in the field.
Yeah, I think I started to come into myself a little bit by the end of that in terms of, you know, gleaning some skills and.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Where was the next step for you then in that?
Well, you know, sort of aging out of that, it was a time when there's lots of things collided in my life, including the suicide of my younger brother. And then politically, there was a move to cut services for high-risk youth, or sorry, for families with, you know, at risk or vulnerable families. Right. And I just couldn't face working in that field. That was part of it, but working in the field when we could just see another wave of youth that we could have helped early and upstream,
right,
coming at us because supports had been pulled back a little bit.
Right.
So I backed out, and I was working in the STI clinic, the public health clinic, and that was super interesting, doing some walk-in. And but right at the time, at the end of the time, I was invited to give a talk for Island Health on youth addictions, and I was offered a job with Physician Health at the time, and Physician Health is super interesting because physicians were super resilient, empowered group. We're also have the same vulnerabilities as street youth. We have the same degree of vulnerability as street youth, the same degree of barriers to care that street youth do. And that's outrageous if you think about street youth. You know, they're turned away from clinics, and
right,
they're discouraged to go to Emerge, and there's often not a clinic that's low barrier and appropriate for street involved youth. And and physicians have totally the flip side of the coin, like, but we have barriers to care, and then we have these horrible outcomes of burnout and highest rates of suicide of any college age match group. Like we win the award for
right,
burnout and suicide, and then we have all the other struggles of relational struggles and isolation and addictions and things. And so I was invited to do that, and it really resonated with me.
Okay.
Then I'd had some professionalism concerns, i.e. I had been disciplined,
okay, you know,
'cause I was brittle and yeah. So, I mean, it totally jazzed me to work with my peers. I was young, you know, I still felt like I was just entering the age where I might have some of the maturity to do that.
Right.
It was about 11 years ago. I probably am getting it now, sure, but that was a huge privilege. And then I ended up, of course, being more interested in the addictions part right, of it.
So yeah, you kind of got brought. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so is that what kind of got you on to the addiction medicine consult service then?
Totally.
Is that,
yeah. Yeah. Is so then the next step. Right. Yeah. Thanks, Blake. So the next step was that I was like, okay, well, I've figured this out, you know, for the first few steps. But I actually have no formal applicable knowledge for physicians.
Right.
You know,
okay,
if I'm going to work with physicians, you know, I work with street youth and I did motivational enhancement around crystal meth and I forget how to do all these other things. And
right,
and my training was out of my van in Toronto and downtown Vancouver and at raves. And is that really applicable? No, it's not. And so I went back and I did some training and I was being certified and I wrote the international exam just when the local service was being started. And right, the director of the program, or who was setting it up at the time, arm wrestled me and won. And again, I'm insecure. I don't have any clinical skills. I haven't been in the hospital for 17 years, I think, at the time, right, and totally out of my league. But I had the knowledge,
right?
And I had some experience. So he was like, "You got to start, and you can't wait,
right,
until we're up and running, and you know, like we're all just going to be developing, and you have to come now." And so
this is the time, right?
So
right,
I did.
Okay.
So I was there on the ground, and yeah, and that was the only way I could have done it.
Right. And how is the concept? You know, obviously this is, you know, developed into, you know, quite an established, you know, program. How was it pitched at first? What was the, you know, what was the initial implementation of a project?
Yeah. I mean, I probably shouldn't speak to that too much, but yeah, you know, Dr. Herring showed up in town and had this visionary way of, you know, he snowball sampled everybody in town. He interviewed everybody who is involved with substance use in the city, right, community providers and hospitalists who were doing the work and administrators, and he chatted with everybody and
right,
and you know, what is needed here, what would fly, and he he tried to set up a, and did beautifully, a consult service, which is a consultancy where we, you know, hospital, like people in the physicians teams in the hospitals who want an opinion or support of any patient, whether it's an emerge or ICU or psychiatry or anywhere else in the hospital, an opinion or support around any addiction.
Right.
So there would be a physician, a social worker, and an outreach worker, somebody like a peer worker, and try to help people in the transition into hospital through emergency, help them stay in hospital, be supported, connecting optimally to services, and transition as they left the hospital, but then also trying to, you know, increase capacity to address some of the substance use stuff from a very crisp medical perspective in hospital.
Right.
So building capacity for the other physicians, our own capacity, and just trying to have better medical outcomes, like people staying right. if they need to stay in hospital, and not leaving because they feel like they're not being treated well medically. But it was this small team of physician, social worker, outreach worker. It's blossomed into both hospitals now, local hospitals, and quite a robust big team now.
Right. Yeah, you know, and what I, you know, really encourages me, this is one of my, you know, favorite programs I think that Umbrella is a part of. And I think it is the fact that we're looking at an issue from such a comprehensive, you know, so many different angles, you know, the fact that this, obviously there are medical concerns that need to be addressed. You know, there's obviously system navigation and advocacy that needs to happen on the social worker side, but then there's also this non-clinical piece that, you know, just that human element to, you know, providing that care and seeing where people are at and knowing that these are such complex issues, that addiction goes way beyond the substance, you know, and the complications that go around that. It's so much more of the social aspect to it and the economic, you know, piece to that. And, you know, it's really, for me, I just really love how the team tackles it in such a comprehensive way, you know.
100%.
Yeah.
And that we have three parts of the team and they're all equally important. They're mm-hmm. critical. And sometimes, you know, the physician isn't involved and sometimes the social worker is just the peer worker or just right. the, you know, yeah, it's very cool.
Well, and I feel that, and I've, you know, been at times where that, delineation, it doesn't, you know, there is still a hierarchy and that is something that I don't feel. I think that's kind of special to, you know, the AMCS program is how it is. There is this kind of equal, you know, footing for all of the workers and all elements to the team. And so I really respect that. And it's cool too, seeing, you know, so many new young doctors that are kind of getting into addictions medicine as well. And, you know, how that's expanded, you know, I think as far as the pool is concerned of doctors involved, it seems like it's more than it used to be. Is that?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's growing. Yeah. So the involvement with the Umbrella and the outreach workers for me goes back around the time in this transition before I went into, or about the time I was going into physician health. As I said, I was working in a walk-in clinic over the years, and Gordon Harper, who was the original guy that set up the Umbrella, as far as I understand, you know, he found me, as it were, and he mentored me, and he would bring future Umbrella clients to me.
Right.
You know, people who are unattached to GP. So I became their GP. I mean, Gordon right. wouldn't take no for an answer. And he'd tell me what to do. You know, he'd tell me how to do it. And without that work with the Umbrella at the time, there's no way I could do my job. And right. so it was actually really, really pivotal learning for me and support for me
right.
to be part of this virtual physician outreach worker team in a walk-in clinic before any of this existed.
Okay.
And so that was really exciting for me to come into this, show up at this team, you know, in the early days and every day now, when Umbrella was there formally.
Right.
Because I, you know, I definitely means a lot to me to be an ally or to be seen as an ally, but also to, you know, the Umbrella workers have been huge teachers for me in right. how to do it. And the equivalence of Umbrella workers going way back to street involved youth, you know, talking right. to me about how do you do this? Yeah. Right. Super fascinating.
Right.
Yeah.
And as far as, you know, a program like this and sustainability with, you know, obviously we've kind of expanded the program and, you know, that's now, yeah, both hospitals and we're trying to get, you know, longer days and we have supports in the ER and PEZ as well. And, you know, as far as, is this a sustainable, like funding wise and cost wise, would you think? I mean, what's your take on a program, well, you know?
You know, when I first started, I'd been, you know, been working in the community and I'd been, you know, recently having left the youth clinic, which was always struggling for just a few more sessions for physicians to provide some care. And a lot of that work was volunteer. And we're, you know, getting free rent and everything was on a shoestring. You know, it was a smelly, urine-stained, unpainted hallway. And, and we're just doing what we can, right? And then showing up at the hospital, having not been there for, as I said, like a decade and a half or more, I was pretty confronted about just how expensive everything in the hospital is. Like, what does an ICU stay cost for somebody? Right. What does an eMERGE visit cost? What does an eMERGE visit with a 2-day stay cost? What is an IV antibiotic treatment for an infected heart valve from injection drug use cost? And thinking back to that heartbreak that I was experiencing when I was seeing some of the cuts to vulnerable families and just calculating in my head, which would be like one ICU stay down the road for somebody could have provided an outreach worker support or some formalized and very significant support for some of these families that we know would benefit from support and would change the trajectory of human lives, like their kids. And so I've struggled with that over the years, but the consult service is, you know, it's trying to be super efficient and it's providing really good care. It's keeping, I think it's increasing the efficiency of the care,
right?
But having come from the community and the looking at vulnerable youth in our community and seeing the disparity between acute care and the upstream funding was difficult to digest initially.
Right. And I think that's something that we still see, right? I think you bring up a great point. Every time someone comes into the hospital, this is incredibly, you know, expensive. And, you know, my work, you know, I had a role, up at VIRCC in the, you know, with Umbrella, but, you know, the criminal justice system and how expensive that is and the mm-hmm. court system. And, and you're totally right. If that early intervention is something that seems to be the hardest to obtain funding for, but you would think would save so much money in the long run, right? It's, you know, if this is a funding thing, I think we end up paying for it one way or the other, you know, and just usually more unfortunate circumstances when, you know, someone's health is deteriorated or, you know, the laws got involved. Yeah. So I guess is that kind of part of it for you is?
That's exactly it. That's exactly right. Yeah. I don't think it's easy and I don't have any answers, but I had a lot of those sort of confronting feelings about just how sad it is to be doing such expensive interventions on people when we could have changed the trajectory of their lives potentially significantly earlier.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, as we stand now in this, you know, current landscape, what's your take on it? What, I mean, and obviously there's been so much development, in our knowledge around addiction and our interventions, you know, we definitely don't have a handle on it yet. And, you know, some people would even say things are, you know, worse than it, but what's working, what's going well but what are the challenges that you still face on a day-to-day basis or the things that still kind of, you know, break your balls a little bit and grind you down? What's working? What's not from your, you know, perspective or.
Yeah. I mean, let's focus. I mean, from a very personal perspective, working, you know, I feel super lucky to be working on the Addiction Consult Service and to have worked with street involved youth at the youth clinic and to have had the training and to see this thing evolve. It's, you know, I'll defer to sort of the heartbreak and where I fear we're going and what's not working. for a minute, but personally, I think there's lots of things that are really working well. And I think the acuity, the severity, the heartbreak of the, you know, the current opioid climate skews us to think we're not doing enough, and maybe we aren't, but, and things aren't going well, but, you know, I was around before there was Umbrella, before there was an AMCS, before there was a youth clinic in town, before there was Suboxone and Cadian and any, all sorts of other things. And, you know, I just think we're doing, I think a lot of the stuff we're doing is really great,
right?
Really intensely awesome. And I think we forget that.
Right. Sure.
You know, like the fact that, I don't know, just all of it. I just think it's really, we're doing good work.
Hmm.
It's there's lots of need, and it's heartbreaking, but to see all these things and, you know, policies and people in senior positions and nursing addiction fellowships and social worker addiction fellowships, and this, as you were saying, like there's lots of training of new people in all sorts of different fields coming up, and right. Very strong in, and all the way out to, you know, but the academic institutions where people are looking at the neurobiology of it, and the fundamental sciences of it. And it's, anyway, I just think we're doing lots.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's the problem. I'm glad that you say that, because, you know, I think a lot of times we, you know, it's easy to fall on, you know, what's not working.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, yeah, the doom and gloom, but right, there is progress. And, you know, and yeah, I've seen, you know, seen that, you know, like you were just mentioning, you know, Cadian, Suboxone, you know, just having different interventions for opiate replacement therapy, essentially, and having options for folks trying to, you know, really beat a really, really challenging, you know, aspect of their life, right?
Yeah.
And to get on the other side of it, the fact that there is some agency that they can still take into what that looks like for them, I think is really amazing. And yeah, yeah.
And disseminating sort of knowledge among clinicians. Like when I was studying like almost 20 years ago, Dr. Mead in the inner city was saying, look, you know, like Europeans and Australians are using these medicines for alcohol, you know, naltrexone and acamprosate. How come we're not in Canada? Right. And so like, of course it's, and everybody knows it now. Every medical student knows about these things, and we're right. Commonly used. So yeah, I think there's lots coming. I mean, you know, the trouble, there's lots of trouble, but back when crystal meth sort of was the first drug of, you know, that we could make synthetically, it sort of reminded us just how wildly capable humans are at creating their own destruction.
Mm.
And it was the first, and we could see them coming. I remember sitting at a conference up at UVic and saying, like, I don't know what's coming next, but something's coming next.
Really?
And I did not predict fentanyl.
Right.
But other people might have, like, it was like, okay, what's our next synthetic drug that we are now going to make, and it's going to be the next tsunami. And since that time, we've seen fentanyl and then maybe some synthetic benzos or benzo analogs like etizolam, and mm-hmm. I don't know what's coming next, but
right,
it's not going to be good.
Right.
Like, we're good at figuring this out. We're good at eclipsing our own sort of our own dopamine reward pathways with social media, and, you know, degrading our sense of identity and with AI, our sense of intimacy. And
right.
Like, we're clever.
Right.
It's not going to be good.
Figure this out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it's trying to just stay on top of as best you can. And, you know, how do we roll with those punches when they come
in?
And,
yeah.
And, you know,
so I think you were asking two things, like what, you know, I don't want to get down the question of like, what do I think should happen? Because I think that's a big, it's a dangerous trap for somebody who has some experience in one field. In particular, I think physicians, we think we should weigh in different areas. I want to stay in my lane. Like, I don't have any epidemiological training. I don't have any public health training of significance. I don't have any policy. I'm not a policy analyst or a policy developer.
Right.
I'm not a politician, you know, like, I don't know how to do these things. Like, mm-hmm. I know how to be a worker bee.
Right.
And I took some steps into, you know, a little bit of admin, and that didn't go well. And I,
right.
you know, I'm a worker bee.
Yeah.
And I like that. And so what goes well for me is the day to day work on the team, work in the hospital, which is a radically different supportive environment now, and then these profound moments with patients that come every now and then, which are riveting and intimate, that stick with me, and some of those I've shared with umbrella workers along the way, and they're so remarkable that it definitely overshadows all the work. It's super, super meaningful.
Right. You have those moments. And I think that's, you know, for me, that's what kept me in this line of work, was those moments, those breakthroughs, or just, you know, those moments of clarity I think it's really cool. And then the profound connection that you can develop with, you know, and I think seeing in the hospital as well, it's, you know, at least in my limited experience, you know, working that program, and, you know, you definitely see people at their vulnerable, you know, the most vulnerable, and people kind of sometimes at their lowest, and there's some really beautiful human quality that you can get out of that. And it's really cool to see people maybe even contemplate making a change that never have thought about it before. You know, they may be scared shitless and not know where to go, but just having that idea that, hey, I'm worth it. And, you know, and I do want to be here, and I do want to, you know, change, you know, my course, you know, that's pretty, pretty impactful moments that you can have.
It's huge,
right?
Boy.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you're, you know, when you're, you know, approaching clients, and do you kind of have like a general sense? Is it just a, you know, obviously you're seeing individuals with, you know, alcohol use disorder, which has very different, you know, you have people that are in psychosis, you know, coming with, you know, meth and, you know, stimulant use. You have, you know, opioid users, and people are coming off of overdose. Do you approach every situation differently? Do you kind of come in not knowing what to expect, or do you have like a certain, you know, approach that's kind of consistent throughout your line of work, or how do you go about, you know, and like every situation too? And I think this is what the general public doesn't understand. Every situation is so complex and so unique and individual to someone. Yeah. How do you as a, you know, professional approach these situations when you probably have 12 really, really, you know, or more, hard, you know, situations to kind of walk into on any given day?
Yeah, I have a bunch of things in my head that I value, and that they're lessons that people have taught me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, patients and outreach workers primarily. And then I do enjoy the nerdy medicine. There's no way around that, you know?
Totally.
So I find it academically and, you know, intellectually very interesting. So okay. I enjoy that, and I know that, and I'm comfortable with that, and that drives a lot of what I do. But you're asking about when I walk into a patient's space, whether it's a cubicle in Emerge, or they're up their chair in the psychiatric Emerge, the PEZ, or in a ward room, there's a few things that I always remind myself, and the first thing is that, and these are lessons that other people have taught me, and sometimes very intentionally,
right.
They've sat me down to tell me this, or I've had those aha moments at lectures or all sorts of different places. But one of the things is that anything that is told to me by someone is a gift.
Right.
They are putting something on the table. They don't have to. They've chosen to, and that is a gift to me. That's a,
right.
And to see what that is, and to honor that,
right.
is super important for me.
Right.
By the words of Dr. Baker and Ray Baker, one of the grandfathers or grandparents of, for me, for medicine, addiction medicine in BC. You know, he said we have to, and I've heard this mentioned a lot since then, but it is that we have to believe in people until they believe in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There is, we all know there's so much shame and humiliation and vulnerability in having failed somehow. And addiction is one of those things that is seen personally by, you know, I think by people that way. and I'm, I just don't want any of that stuff to come from me.
Right.
And
right.
I want to see the humanity in that person, and I want to see their strength. And working with youth taught me to focus on the strengths and the resiliency of that person. But I definitely don't want to have any judgment. And, you know, there's lots about myself I've historically and probably even now, you know, ashamed of, or I felt those feelings. And, I've watched our family struggle with a recurrent psychotic illness and a suicide of my brother, and the kind of how that breaks down one's own, like, oh, you know, oh, we all have failings. We all have faults. Mm. And I see right. that in myself. And I think that's the thing I love about working with Umbrella Workers, is that I think you guys have this huge, I don't even know if you're aware of it, but you've done personal work with that in a way that's humbling and rebuilding. And I try to emulate that. I try to emulate right. you guys, you know, right. and that sort of non-judgmental, and I'm like trying to be there. I try to eat before I go in, so I'm not sure. hungry. I honestly try to have no expectations. It's right. like, and I'll say to them, look, this is what I would like, but it's irrelevant.
Right.
What do you know, what, where are you at? And I'm not going to help people move in motivation or change if I come out and I'm othering them, I'm shaming them, I'm more powerful, I'm more, I know what's right.
Right.
I just need to be curious and supportive and grateful.
Right.
And not hungry and grouchy.
There you go.
Right?
So, right. You got to take care of yourself.
I totally have to take right. care of myself. I have to go into the nurse's room and I have to have a cookie.
Right.
And have a pee. Totally. And take a breath.
Yep. Right. Yeah. Right.
Get your head and then on pretend straight. I'm an outreach worker.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's, yeah. I mean, that's amazing. And I think that is so wonderful to, you know, I really wish that we had more doctors that, you know, and I think we do. And, you know, it's that really is that human element to it. You know, I think is just so encouraging. I think that's why you've, you know, got so much respect from our team is exactly what you just said, you know, just coming in and meeting people on a human level and meeting people where they're at. And, you know, we say this all the time too, you know, working with family members who want us to, you know, they should be doing this and this, and nah, it's the individual's choice. Yeah. Like you say, I want this, but where are you at? What are you totally. Wanting? Right. Yeah. And actually having that humility to meet people where they're at. I think it's a gift, you know, that you have. And I really appreciate, you know, that's really what we try to instill in our workers too, is that always find that human element, you know, and try to meet people where they're at. And we never know too, and I'm sure you've seen this, you know, some people it takes a bunch of times coming through, but every positive interaction plants a seed and might be 100%. That tipping scale, maybe not now, but maybe, you know, down the road that they've kind of held on to and remembered, right? So yes. Every interaction is important. Yeah.
Somebody believes in me.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Even if I don't right now.
Right. Yeah. No, I love that.
Yeah. So Blake, I want to build on what you just said before you go on.
Yeah.
It's self-serving too, what I do. Like I'm, you know, I'm shy and I, you know, I have a tendency to isolate at times I've really benefited socially by working and, you know, maybe too much. So, by working on a team in the hospital and working in the hospital and paradoxically I'm chatty, and that's how you and I met.
Right.
Because I'm chatty.
Right.
In the gym.
Totally.
And so these, you know, chatting, I love it.
Right.
When I approach this way, it's very much self-serving. Like I really enjoy it. And I grew up in the bush and I like chatting with a large range of people.
Right.
And, when I was in high school, I was the nerdy, athletic, straight A student, and I wanted to go to the parties. Mm. And my rough and tumble, like really rough and tumble, you know, some of them are dead, some of them were, you know, very different life trajectories, would protect me.
Mm.
And they would say, Doug, you're not going to that party. That party's not for you.
Right.
And so I've been long influenced by being looked after by all sorts of people and respecting all types. And so I just really enjoy chatting with people and right. chatting with patients. So I want to be really clear, like it's self-serving.
Right. Yeah.
Like no, I enjoy right. it.
And well, I think that's, you know, and that's what I was going to ask, you know, what keeps you in this line of work, you know, what kind of, so it's that connection, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure.
I like people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you, I mean, in my experience, man, I've had some of the most genuine, most beautiful conversations and that, like you say, are self-serving in a jail, you know, on a unit in a jail or in the hospital when someone's, you know, down out, there's these moments of just meeting people and just this authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, comes and yeah. So I think there is that both ways. Right. And I'm glad that, you know, and I think that's, like I said, probably why you've been able to be sustainable in this line of work is that, you know, you actually enjoy it and you like the people and you believe in them too. And I think that's, you know, I love that what you're saying, you know, we need to believe in folks until they, you know, believe in themselves. I think that's,
it's really, not my line, but
no,
it's
but that's
one of my
right.
mantras.
That's a good mantra. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's, just people to know that people are in their corner and believe in them, man, mm-hmm. that's a pretty special thing. Yeah.
And maybe it's like, I just believe in their validity and their humanness. And I see that and kind of love that.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, do you ever see the trajectory? And it's hard because you're catching people at that ground zero and then you kind of send them off and hopefully they're, you know, connected and they go off to treatment. Do you ever, you know, do you ever get the other side of it where you get to see the success stories? You know, I'm very lucky because, you know, I get to see kind of both ends of the spectrum. You know, there's the ground zero when people that are still in the thick of it, but then also people that got on the other side of it and, you know, got some time under their belt. Do you ever get that, or do you just have to trust that that's happening?
It's less often. You're right. Right. It's not structurally set up that I run into the people. It's a little bit more random and a little bit more of the sadder side of stuff. But mm-hmm. but it is the moments of peeling back of any facade or any distraction from their humanness that mm-hmm. that keep me going. I remember one time with when I was first training, I had my first like, oh wow, I was with an interview room, like in a clinic with a young guy who was injecting methamphetamine and heroin at the time, and they said they talked about meta thinking and watching themselves and for the first time in their life calling themselves on what they were doing.
Oh wow.
And I was like, wow, now if you're going to put that on the table in front of me, that is a gift.
Right.
And I'm going to remember that one. Like, and it was just so moving for me to be allowed to see that kind of awareness emerging in someone who had been distracting themselves and were right. talking about that,
yeah.
how they had been keeping them that from themselves and right. that they no longer could because they had had that moment when they held it up to themselves right. and wanted to share that with me. And then it was all that, like, okay, now how do I find hope and courage and strength and a route out,
right.
or struggle with knowing that and not yet be able to.
Right. Sure. You're starting to become aware, like, but
totally,
right. Right.
Totally.
You'd also know the path ahead is a long and hard one. Yeah.
And, you know, often really almost close to impossible.
Right.
And so terrifying. And I'm like, yeah. So it was just, those are the parts rather than the, like, oh, I see people who recover. I always hold a recovery, vision.
Mm-hmm.
I see that strength in Umbrella Workers. I just tried to express that, and I try to live those kinds of things in my life But it's the, I don't see those stories as often as I expect you to see them.
Right. Well, you know, the good thing is, you know, that they are out there, you know, and there are a whole lot of people that, I mean, their story begins in the hospital, and it begins with a moment, you know, meeting yourself and, you know, and our team, you know, that's mm-hmm. a lot of times they can be in a whole fog, and then all of a sudden they end up in the hospital. And those conversations are really pivotal a lot of times in people's, you know, decision to, you know, kind of have that conviction and courage to make that change. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of times I hear people reflecting upon those stays in the hospital and the interaction with the team. So, mm-hmm. I think it's incredibly valuable work, and I agree. It would be great to have, you know, to mitigate, the amount of, you know, I know that you guys see just a, you know, it's a incredible influx of people coming in on a daily basis. And hopefully we can start getting some infrastructure in place where the early interventions can mitigate that. But in the meantime, the work that you guys do is absolutely amazing. And I just love your able to blend the clinical approach with the human approach. And I think it's something that, you know, yeah, you can tell that you're still passionate about it. And you know, we really appreciate it and appreciate, you know, what you're doing for our community. And I think it has a huge impact, probably more than you know. So.
Very sweet, Blake. Yeah. And it's a lot of teachers, mm-hmm. a lot of time, and as I say, it sort of feeds me too. So
right on.
My pleasure. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, it was great to have you come in. You know, if we ever need any more, you know, clinical take on something, I might end up start doing some round tables with these, you know, so I may ask you back in. You might not be completely off the hook yet there, Doug.
I have that nerdy. I like the nerdy science, okay. You know, the, so I'm always happy to chat about that stuff. So if there's for sure, if there's components of like the medicine part of it,
yeah,
happy to chat.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks so much for taking the time, brother.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks once again to Doug for taking the time out of his busy schedule to come onto the program. I feel like his caring and dedication to the work he does is absolutely heroic and nothing short of miraculous. The fact that Doug can show up day after day in such an intense workplace and strive in earnest to make genuine human connections is just something incredible, and it's something that our entire community feels. So thanks again to Doug. And I will just mention, I think we heard Laika, our house dog at Foundation House, make a guest appearance. She's down in the office for the day, so she wanted to make her presence known. So maybe I'll get her on the program sooner than later. Anyways, our season of Comfortably Unnumb just keeps on rolling along. I still have a couple more folks from this year's recovery campaign to interview, so we will be getting back to that in 2 weeks' time when we drop our next podcast. Until then, for the Umbrella Society, my name is Blake Anderson.